Let's see, today is the 14th, I believe. Let's turn to Esther to start out with tonight. We'll finish that up. Probably there's never been in all of the plays and movies and dramas and stories and so on anyone with a plot that could beat that of Esther. It's a great book. The setting of Esther, the time setting, is about 461. It's 461 B.C. And if you do a little bit of figuring on that, I think you'll find that that's about in the midst of their 70 years of captivity. They have about 35 years yet to go until they'll be emancipated. Now, their emancipation occurred when Cyrus took Babylon. 426 B.C. And that emancipated the Jews, so their servitude and captivity were over. Desolations went just a little bit further, not very many years. The desolations were over just 3 or 4 years before the temple was dedicated. The people gotten back in the land and started cultivating again and building their houses and so on, and so the desolations ended there. But 405 was one of the great points in prophetic history, you might say, and has to do with prophetic truth too. The dedication of a new temple that was built under Ezra and Nehemiah. And so Esther comes before that. Now, I said here that Esther's date was about 461. Now, just a few years after that, in 454, and Ahasuerus was still reigning as king, and Nehemiah was his cupbearer. You read this in Nehemiah. And Nehemiah just heard, after all of these years, that the temple had been destroyed and Jerusalem had been laid waste. They'd been brought captive over there and never heard what happened to their city. And so when Nehemiah heard that news, he was pretty sad. And so the king saw it. He was pretty well downcast. His corners of his mouth were down. They asked him what the trouble was. And of course, position of cupbearer was one of the most dangerous positions you could be in. You made a mismove, you could just lose your head right then and there. And he prayed real quickly, well, the quickest any man ever did pray, I suppose, and told the king what he had heard and why he was sorry. And so the king, Ahasuerus there, made a decree. Now that decree is the starting point of the prophecy in Daniel 9:24 that has to do with the first coming of Christ. 9:25, I mean, the first coming of Christ. And it has to do with 49 years, or 7 sevens, and then 62 sevens, and Messiah cut off, making a total of 69 sevens. That's all there is in that prophecy, is 69. Nothing else mentioned. But when it came down to the dedication of the temple, it was where the 70 weeks, the 490 years began on issue. And by the time that Paul made his famous sentence in Acts 28:28, 67 of those weeks had passed, leaving 3 yet to go. Now, I kind of bring that up again because I've been having some correspondence. Some folks have a hard time of getting this through their heads, and not many people have ever seen that there were 2 prophecies in Daniel 9:24 and 25. And in the opposite order, as far as the occurrence is concerned, like it is in Genesis 3:15. The second coming of Christ is mentioned first there, and then the first coming. And you find those things in the Bible quite often. Well, I wonder why. Well, about the only thing that I know about that is just this, that God wants us to study and work it out. I found when I was teaching school, if I just up and told them everything, why, they didn't bother about studying. Didn't make much progress. I give them a little hint as to what was going on, give them an assignment to read and so on, and then that was something different. That's where education began. And so God's Word has the truth in it, all right, but not in always in a chronological order, or not always in what we think would be a logical order. Of course, we do find that God is a lot more logical than we are. And if we just dig deep enough, we find that He has a purpose in putting the things in the order He does. That's a little hard to dig out sometimes, too. Well, we're ready for the 12th chapter of Esther. Now, the 9th chapter. 9th chapter of Esther. Still got Daniel in my mind. We have had the story so far that King Ahasuerus had set Vashti aside because she wouldn't appear unveiled or naked or something before the great company he had. There are different stories about that. And there was a beauty contest, and Esther was selected as the new queen. And her uncle was Mordecai, and he had brought her up because her parents seemingly were dead. And Mordecai sat in the gate at the palace. He had a little recognition, not what he should have had, we find. We have another warning here. It is very, very interesting person, and that is a man by the name of Haman. And he had 10 sons. And this all brings about quite a story, because we find that Haman, who's an Amalekite, now, I wonder if we hadn't ought to break in right here and get a little something on that. Now, this book was written by a man who purports to be a Jew, Velikovsky. And he has a little part here, a section almost like a chapter, the confusion of Hyksos and Israelites and the beginning of anti-Semitism. Rather interesting. The Israelites could never forget the time of their suffering in Egypt, but they did not bear any hatred against the Egyptians or other people of antiquity. The Amalekites alone became the symbol of evil and the object of their hate. Now notice that they never hated Egyptians, and there's no record in our Bible that they ever warred against the Egyptians. And in prophecy, there's also a promise for the Egyptians in the future, rather closely related as a child, or as also Israel. And the Israelites were always told to respect the Egyptians because they had been a stranger in their land one time. And of course, they were really preserved in Egypt. Now, Deuteronomy 25, 17 to 19, and God is speaking, "Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the Doeg way when you came forth out of Egypt." You see, they attacked them and refused them. And according to some of the figures that we have, they must have had an army of around 400,000 men. And that's a pretty good bunch. 4 million, excuse me. And if Israelites all together coming out of Egypt, men, women, and children all in about 3 million. In fact, by the men who were able to bear arms, 663,550. And so you can make your estimate for the rest of them of that. So remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you came forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of the Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget. And so, you remember how Saul failed when he didn't kill Agag, the name of Agog in secular history, when they took the city of Araris, which was their great stronghold down just north of the border of Egypt, or south of, no, north of the border of Egypt, on a river. And by the way, their strategy was almost the same as when Cyrus took Babylon. So King Saul and the Egyptians were able at that time to utterly break the backbone of the Amalekite Empire. But this Haman here in the story of Esther is about the lone survivor, he and his wife and his 10 sons. Now, the utter wickedness of this people was iterated and reiterated throughout the old literature. How they came to suck the blood of the weary in the desert. How cowardly they act in attacking from ambush. How vile and ignoble and merciless they were. They mutilated the wounded and blasphemed by throwing the mutilated parts of the bodies toward the heavens and jeered at the Lord. A legend presents the feeling of the Israelite nation in these symbolic words. So long as the seed of Amalek exists, the face of God is, as it were, covered, and lonely, and will only then come to view when the seed of Amalek shall have been exterminated. There was also a tradition that God bade Moses impress upon the Jews to repulse no heathen should he desire conversion, that is, to become a proselyte, but never accept an Amalekite as a proselyte. And of course, they were barred for no, as well as the Canaanites. For his sins, Amalek shall first descend to hell. God himself took up the war against Amalek. Now that was a little bit of it. I have another paragraph over here. Well, let's see. Mike, go ahead here. The Hyksos. You see, here was where the trouble was. In the ancient records, the Hyksos were some who invaded Egypt, and some people thought that they were the Israelites. And so some of the history has done that. You get a little of that here, but that's the Hyksos were the Amalekites. And the Israelites were the Habirim, as some of them call them. That's almost Hebrew. The Hyksos engendered the same hatred in the Egyptians. Their extreme cruelty and their wantonness were cut deep into the memory of the people. They defiled and burned rolls of papyri and objects of art. In their camps, they tortured their captives. Heads were cracked open, teeth smashed, eyes gouged out, limbs hacked off. They professed faith only in their superior strength and employed it in their camps on their defenseless victims. Even the Arabian authors exposed the evil and the recklessness of the Amalekites in dealing with the holy and the profane in Mecca and in Egypt. They too proclaimed that the Lord had sent them away from Mecca for their iniquity. And it was the lot of Saul to carry on the war of liberation of Israel and Egypt. That the Israelites were not remembered with praise for what they had done for Egypt and referred to as one and they in Egyptian history. That's just the pronouns all used. Was the least of the injustices. Their real reward at the hands of the Egyptian historians was to be identified with the ravagers and whom the Israelites had driven out of Araris. Well, the first wave of anti-Semitism in the East was spread much later in the Persian Empire by the vizier, that is, the prime minister, Haman, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. Haman, who was the seed of Agog, the Amalekite, conspired to destroy the Jewish population in Persia and Media. We may well imagine that the traditions of Haman's house were likely to inspire this hatred. These traditions told how Haman's royal forefather, Agog, had been dispossessed by a Jewish king and killed by a Jewish prophet. In the Greek world, no signs of racial antipathy before Jews can be traced until the stories of Manetho began to circulate. The Jews were occasionally looked upon as a mysterious people, but no expression of animosity or contempt is preserved in the writings of the old authors. Various references are by Theophrastus, Phiarchus, Lasoli, and Megasthenes, philosophers who flourished at the end of the 4th and beginning of the 3rd century before this era. And one of them wrote, "They, that is the Jews, are a race of philosophers, and they do not cease to occupy themselves with the divinity." And Phiarchus, he said, "The Jews and descended from the philosophers of India. The philosophers called in India Kalanius and in Syria Jews. The name of their capital is very difficult to pronounce. It is called Jerusalem." Of course, in Latin is Hierusalem. And that higher, of course, is hierarchy, priesthood. Well, I won't read any more from this, but give you some ideas. Some of these folks started mixing the Israelites with those Amalekites. the Axis, and so started a wave of hatred over the world, and still going on. I give you a little idea of where that started. I can remember around 40 years ago that the what were the names of those papers? The Protocols of Zion. They were being published and scattered all over this country. There's some woman up here in Chicago, I forgot her name, which was really at the bottom of that thing. And of course, they're accusing the Jews of little everything. I mean, especially they were trying to get world dominion and to control everything in the world and so on. And didn't give them a very bad, give them a very good reputation in many ways. So that gives us a little background on what we were having to deal with here, because it was quite some time, you see, before Esther here that King Saul had licked the Amalekites along with the Egyptians at Horus. Now that King Saul was crowned king in 1000 B.C. And so here we are in 461, so you see this is about 450 years later, or more. Now in the 12th month, Esther 9, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, that is, all the Jews would be killed, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, parenthesis, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them, end of parenthesis, the Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. And all the rulers of the provinces, 127 of them, and the lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the king helped the Jews. Now, we made mention of the fact last week that these folks who are really enemies of Jews were an alien population for the most part, living in Medo-Persia, of other countries which they had conquered and so on. And they were really the ones who were the enemies of Jews. Medo-Persia didn't seem to have anything against them particularly. And it says here in verse 5, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon him. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out through all the province. For this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. He was a little bit in King Ahasuerus' court, like Daniel was in Nebuchadnezzar's court, and Joseph in the king, to the king in Egypt, and Moses could have been the next king of Egypt, probably, adopted by the king's daughter. So here you have Jews. There's four instances, you see, where they got to be what we'd call prime minister of the country in which they lived. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and slaughter, and destruction, and did what they would unto them for those that hated them. And in Shushan, the palace, now, the name of the city was Shushan, the palace was also Shushan, so keep that in mind. The Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. And Harsh and Datha, and Daphan, and Asapha, and Poratha, and Adalia, and Aradatha, and Parmashta, and Arasai, and Aradai, and Vazzatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they. But on the spoil they laid not their hands. Now the edict had been, when Esther asked for it and so on, that they might take everything. The Jews wouldn't do that. They wouldn't take any spoil, whatever. They just killed the people of their enemies and let it go with that. Well, they couldn't be too much blamed then, could they? They weren't killing them to rob them or something like that. It wasn't that. They wanted that to be understood. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition? It shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. You see, in the very first place, he had told her that she could have anything she wanted, even up to half of the kingdom. In other words, she could be his partner on the throne. Well, now we have one woman who did that. And she is mentioned in the Bible history, not by name, but she's given a descriptive title. She's called the Queen of Sheba. Her name is Hatshepsut. And it is just possible that she was a sister-in-law to Solomon, because Solomon married the daughter of the king, and she was a daughter of the same king. Whether the same mother, and I wouldn't know. And no wonder that she said that she hadn't been told a half of it. Her sister told her a lot about Solomon's glory and the reign over there and so on, but she hadn't heard a half of it. Well, it's interesting to read the story of her going over there, the way she went by the Gulf of Aqaba, and the gifts that she took, which are pictured on the walls of a temple in Egypt that she had put up. The whole history is there. And yet, tradition today persists, says that she was a queen of Ethiopia, a colored woman. Well, she might have been colored at that, but not in Ethiopia. Now, the ancient Egyptians of that time were a colored race. You can see that in the pictures that they have, their bas-reliefs and so on. However, part of their rulers were of another country at part of the time. There were Assyrians and whatnot. And it seems that their priestly caste were Chaldean in origin, coming, of course, from Babylon. And Chaldean, well, Ur of the Chaldees is where Abraham came from. And Joseph married a daughter of an Egyptian priest, so evidently he married somebody which was rather related to the Jewish race. That's rather interesting, too. And, of course, the same thing was said about Moses. He married an Ethiopian. Well, Arabia, the land of Midian, was at that time called Ethiopia. And she was from that part, but she wasn't an Ethiopian. She was a Midianite, and her father was a priest of Midian. And Midian is one of the sons of Abraham, like Keturah. Now, these traditions get around and so on, it's pretty hard to jar people loose from them. They just have to believe what they want to believe. Well, then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan, just in Shushan now, to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. Now, you see, we don't know. It says up there in verse 10, they slew them. And it's quite likely that, according to the custom of the Jews, that they were hanged on the gallows after they were dead. The Jews never hung anybody up to let him die. That wasn't their way of doing it. But in a very bad case where somebody's really bad, after he was killed, they would hang him on a tree, for an example, and that person is said to be accursed, according to the law. And, of course, that was given to in the case of the Lord, but in the Roman custom, he was hanged up there to die, and that wasn't the Jewish way of doing things. Well, now, she wants to have ten sons hanged upon the gallows, which Mordecai had prepared, or which Haman had prepared for Mordecai, the Jew. So he's going to get rid of him. And the king commanded it to be done. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day, also the month Adar, and slew 300 men of Shushan, and on the prey they laid not their hands. So that makes a total in of 800, 500, and 300 here the next day. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives, and had rest from their enemies, and slew of their foes 75,000. Now, out of 127 provinces, that wouldn't be very many. It sounds like a lot to us, just giving that figure. There were millions living in these provinces. Remember at one time that Xerxes raised an army of 5 million men and invaded Greece. And still he got licked. Battle of Thermopylae. Pass of Thermopylae. But on the prey that laid not your hand. Let's see here. I got down the wrong verse. All right. But they laid not their hands on the prey at the last of verse 16. Now, on the 13th day of the month Adar, and on the 14th day of the same rest of day, I made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and the 14th thereof, and on the 15th day the same they rested, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month Adar a day of gladness and feasting, and a good day, and of sending portions one to another. Now that was another Jewish custom. It seems to me it was rather a nice one, and I think from what I read and so on that they would send some of their food to some of the folks who didn't have so much. That was a nice thing too. So when they had a big feast, why they'd give some of it away to others or friends, and also to some that needed it. Remember that there was no country back in those days that looked after the poor like the Israelites did. They have no record in any of them ever looked after the poor like they did. Now when it comes a little later around getting close to the first century and so on, when Rome was getting at its height and depth together, why, the politicians began feeding the poor to get their votes. But that was a long time after this. And so they would give them big shows and feed them and so on, put on big races at the Colosseum and had a great time and get put the people to vote for them. Maybe some of the things we have today kind of comes from that too. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both rich and both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly. And before we get down to it, you know what the name of this celebration is? No, it comes too late for Christmas. I will go on in. To establish this among them, they should keep the 14th day of the month, and they are, and the 15th day of the same year, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, and from mourning unto a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them, because Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. That is, he'd cast a lot to find what would be a good day, and it was the 13th of Adar that the lot came on. 13, that was unlucky for him. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Wherefore, they call these days, that is, Purim, after the name of Pur, a lot, casting a lot, or casting the dice, what is it? Therefore, for all the words of this letter, and of that which they had seen concerning this matter, and which had come upon them, the Jews ordained, and took upon them, upon their seed, and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail, that they should keep these 2 days according to their writing, and according to their appointed time, each every year. And that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. And they still observe it today, those who call themselves Jews. And you'll find it on your Jewish calendar. Got one lay on the floor in here. I didn't look that up. I don't remember just what day and what month it is this next year. Then Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail. Now notice there's a comma there. She isn't the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai. But Esther and Mordecai the Jew wrote with all authority to confirm this second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim in their times appointed, according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves, for their seed, the matters of the fasting and their cry. And the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and was written in the book. And I don't remember whether I have that chart up here that shows a little of this or not. We're getting pretty near to the end of the book because there's only three verses in the 10th chapter. I think that as we read this, we must keep in mind that these people, these Israelites, are Lo Ami, not his people. And when we began the book, we mentioned that fact. And that is the reason why that the name of God does not appear in this book. He is doing this for his people, but he's staying in the background. And so there are five times when you find it in acrostics in the Hebrew, four times the name of God and once as really as Jehovah. Shows that he's behind the scenes. He's stirring all this up with his finger, but not openly. Nothing said here about the God of the Jews. This whole book. Strange, isn't it? There's one of the appendices in the Companion Bible gives you a detailed account of these and how that they work, giving even the English equivalent so you can see how that they come out. Button just right. Now, we have the image here which represents the four empires. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. The four empires. In Daniel 7, you have a representative of the lion, the bear, the four-headed leopard, and a nondescript beast which we did. Use our imagination on. What I wanted to get at is over here, Medo Persia is also pictured as a ram. And one horn is higher than the other because Medo and Persia weren't exactly equal power. Now, as far as other nations were concerned, Medo Persia was a bear that really tore things up. Tyrus himself and taken water and licked Babylon, you know. That night that Belshazzar is having his feast. But as far as Israel is concerned, and that's what you have in Daniel 8, a rather peaceable domesticated animal, the ram, because they did do a lot for Israel. Now, we don't find that Israel were particularly persecuted during their stay in Medo-Persia, or the Babylonian captivity. It started in Babylon, really, and you see in 426 it turned into the hands of Medo-Persians. But Medo-Persia was a empire alongside with Babylon. And this Ahasuerus was in some way related by marriage to King Nebuchadnezzar. And as near as we can figure, this decree was made in 454. I don't have that one there. It's before that 426 up there. By Ahasuerus, I spoke of a while ago when Nehemiah was a cupbearer. Now, he was acting as regent for Nebuchadnezzar because of his relationship. If he hadn't kept Nebuchadnezzar's throne for him, he was out in the field 7 years eating grass, why, somebody else would have grabbed it. So there's some interesting history back of all of this, you see, and how that Esther finally comes in. So now, really, when you go taking this history down through here, Esther has a lot more influence and a bigger figure in it than you'd think at the first. Of course, that's politics, normally. But it does show how that during that captivity, that God looked after his people. Now, we do find some mention of God in Daniel. And Daniel was among the first of the captives that are taken by Nebuchadnezzar, 496 B.C. Princes. My grandfather gave me a quarter one time for remembering the names of the three companions of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And, of course, if you remember in the Hebrew, that's worse yet. Mishael, Azariah, and Hananiah. And Daniel's name, you see, was changed to Belteshazzar. And the king had finally followed Nebuchadnezzar, about the fourth one down, with Belshazzar. Saw the handwriting on the wall. I just wanted to see that, to see the relationship there, these empires to Israel. Now, you see, even down there in the third one, in Greece, there is Alexander the Great, the goat with the one horn. And by the way, when you read your Bible about that, you'll find something very interesting. That goat could run faster than anything I know of. It said he ran so fast he didn't touch the ground. How can you imagine that? And he was a swift general. That's the reason why he won so many victories. He was there before they ever expected him. He could move fast. And so he is pictured there as a goat. That one horn you find in the history there, that one horn is broken off and four others grew up there. Because when he died, his four generals took over the kingdom. And one of those was the Ptolemies, which figure in some Bible history. Now, up at the top, we don't have any picture up there in chapter 8 of the relationship to Israel, as far as Babylon is concerned. Just these two. It is said in history that when Alexander the Great came into Jerusalem, and they told him the prophecies and read to him some of these things and showed him about this goat and so on, it referred to him. He was so pleased with it that he left everything intact. He didn't even exact any tribute of them or anything at all. He was friendly to them. It wasn't until many years later that Antioch the Epiphanes come along and did all the damage. And of course, he was noted for that. He even sacrificed a sow on the altar in their temple. Well, all of these work together in our history here. I know a lot of people don't think of Esther being as late as what it was. But you see, Esther came after Israel had their last king. Israel never had any more kings after Nebuchadnezzar put the land into desolation. Now, in their captivity and their servitude, he did put a couple of kings on the throne, and they wouldn't mind what he said, so they were put out of the way, and so there was no king left, and everything was desolated at the Jerusalem, the temple destroyed. Israel just would not. It's rather interesting in this book here by Velikovsky about their Israel's experience at Kadesh Barnea. They met with the Amalekites there too. Those were the giants and so on there that recently occupied that part of the land, the southern part of Palestine. And they looked so fierce, and they'd had one encounter with them and found them very hard to deal with, that the 10 spies said, "We can't do it." Caleb and Joshua says, "Yeah, we can, with God helping." And so there it was. Well, now our last three verses, I'm almost getting off my time here. "And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land, upon the isle of the sea, and all the acts of his power and of his might, and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, wherein the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings?" Not in the Bible. "Of Media and Persia. For Mordecai the Jew was next unto king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed," that is, Israel, his relatives. So that ends the story of Esther, unless you have a question. What would have happened to them if they hadn't? The decree had gone out that these folks were to kill the Jews, and that couldn't be retracted because of the decree. It couldn't be retracted, so he had to make one to counteract it, and that is for the Jews to defend themselves. And God put the fear into them so that the Jews overcame without too much trouble. Well, it was about the only way out, wasn't it? He had gone out that these folks were to kill the Jews, and that couldn't be retracted because of all the Medes and Persians. If the king made a decree, it couldn't be retracted, so he had to make one to counteract it, and that is for the Jews to defend themselves. And God put the fear into them so that the Jews overcame without too much trouble. Well, that was about the only way out, wasn't it?
What's the word Semitic mean?
Shem. Descendants of Shem, Semitic race. See, there were three of them, Ham, Shem, and Japheth.
There carries nothing more on sight from that.
No.
Of
course, now there are quite a few peoples that are Semitic in origin. The Arabs are. They're descendants from, I guess, those who are the Arabs, which are children now, but Midian and Moab and Ammon and the rest of those, which were children of Lot and now of Abraham. All of those are Semitic. Now, the Greeks and the Romans and so on are Japhetic, and the Galatians. Some of my ancestry came from Galatia. Finally settled in England and called Welsh.
The
Amalekites? No, just Haman and his 10 sons, the only ones mentioned who were particularly Amalekites. But they were people who were a mixed population in their country, captives and so on, and maybe many of them freed and so forth, who were desired the death of the Jews. And of course, any of those who were sympathizers with Haman, why, the Jews killed him. But they didn't do it for a purpose of robbing or anything like that. That's the reason why they wouldn't take any of their property. Well, it was a custom back in those days, they should, and it wouldn't have been out of the way according to the customs of time that they had, because they had the same thing then in war as we have in politics today, to the victor won the spoils. That's political philosophy today. Well, time to start another half of this now, another side of the cassette, if you want to put it that way. And I thought I'd hash something over a little bit. You folks have heard a little bit of it. A week ago Sunday, I spoke about it. And I thought I'd talk a little bit more tonight, because This is a subject that people are pretty well mixed on. It really has to do with the state and the standing of the believer. What it really has to do. Although the subject of the talk was the just and the unjust. But, of course, that's been one of the great divisions in Christendom today, is these two ideas of one standing before God. Our Bible tells us that our standing before God is by faith. But there are a lot of denominations in the country today that have it by works. That you can get your salvation by works. You're standing before God. Now, Abraham believed God. It is counted unto him for righteousness. It doesn't tell us that Abraham had righteousness of his own. It doesn't say that. But it says his faith was counted as righteousness. Now, I could show you a dollar bill. It has a picture of a man on it. And some ink, so on.